Welcome to this episode of Strong Kind Podcast. This episode is with Frank Benedetto. Frank is, I'm going to call him an innovator in the healthcare space. He's a physical therapist by background. He runs or is the head of the Honey Badger Project, which is, I'm going to call it a healthcare company that is mission-driven in changing and innovating healthcare. Frank is somebody that has mentored me, has coached me. He's really helped me learn to be more of a leader, be a business owner, and just he's pushed me to better places in my life. And I'm very thankful for him for that. This was a great episode. We talked about just leadership, healthcare, making change, and how hard a lot of this stuff can be, but how rewarding it is at the same time. So really appreciate Frank coming on. Hope you enjoy this episode. Thanks for being here. Peace.
Oh, my clothes out of the way.
No, nobody cares about those. I'm not going to edit this out now, Frank. Mary, so baby.
Our podcast starts with me moving clothes.
This is the reality. You know what I want in 2024, Frank? What year is it? 2025. I want real. I want it to be real. I'm tired of all the bullshit. That's probably been one of my biggest things is I'm just tired of the bullshit. So let's maybe start there. You're going to put them back?
You said you wanted real. There we go.
Dude, I did a podcast with Brad Stolberg. Have you ever heard The Practice of Gratitude?
Yeah.
Or no, Practice of Groundedness? Yeah. He reached out to me. He's like, my buddy shared your page with me and he said to reach out. And this was like a month or two ago. And it is like the universe, man. Cause I just started like, I want to write more. And like that guy's a writer. Right. And, but he's very real, but I was wearing a shirt and Mary's like, you need to change your shirt because if you do two podcasts in the same shirt, you're going to look like an idiot. So I went and put on a sweatshirt. So, all right, let's talk about realness. Because that's something that you've brought back a little bit in your content strategy, you know, and like you're trying to, just for anybody listening, Frank is my mentor. He's been my coach in business and life for a little while now. But you've been trying to do something really hard for a few years now, a lot of years now, which is like change healthcare. And you also see a lot of people like, what's the best word? There's people who like they get into it. Like business coaching is like the next level of money grab. I'm going to be honest. I think it is. I think people like, oh, I started my own business. Now I'm going to tell people how to start their own business. Right. How do you combat that? And how do you keep it real?
Oh man, diving right into the good stuff, Dave. I would say, how do I keep it real? It's an ongoing process of uncovering your layers of bullshit and trying to become aware and outpace the layers of bullshit that you're adding back on. Because I used to think of there's this analogy where we all look through the world with our own lenses on, right? And it's true. So the guidance was you have to be constantly taking off these lenses, but it's like one of those old school ones where you have like 10 or 20. You ever see The Matrix, the guy, the Keymaster?
Yes.
Got the glasses on to have like 10 different things. Well, you take a lens off and you're like, okay, I can see the world more clearly. And then you take another lens off. You're like, wow, I am egotistical still. I thought there was no ego. And then but what I didn't realize probably till pretty recently is that we tend to be taking one off, putting one on, taking one off, putting one on, maybe sometimes taking two off, putting one on, you get a little closer to baseline. And I think in the past couple of months, I had to really take a good look at myself in the mirror and be like, oh, I've accumulated a whole bunch more lenses. It's time to start shedding those.
What were some of the lenses that you noticed? I'll share mine.
Yeah.
You want me to share mine first?
Yeah, go for it.
There's this like helping people is really hard, but I want to help people. But I also like when you know how you go down the intellectual road, well, I'm doing this to help people, but you're really like just kind of helping yourself. And so it's like there's this both this love of people. And then there's just also this like disdain for people who are like, just aren't there yet. They're not ready to change. Right. And all you can do sometimes is freaking love people. Right. and try to be there and try to give guidance, but like some people aren't just ready to learn the lesson. So it's like, I've had to do that multiple times where it's like, hey, I want to like eat to myself, but I want to help you so bad, but like, I can't frick like, and it makes you like almost like, ah, man, why can't you get out of your own way? It's like, they can't see it. Right. So I've had to like consistently, you know, I'm not really that kind, right? The strength and kindness piece is like, it's just kind of funny. Right.
That's not true.
But it is like
such an exaggeration. You're not.
Yeah.
Kind.
I'm pretty freaking kind, but it's like, you know, like you want to help people, but like until people are ready to learn the lesson and you got to kind of accept, you have to be a little accepting, and that can be really hard when you want to make change. Right. When you want to, and when you know people are capable of it, well, maybe don't know, but you want to believe, right? That's like where I'm constantly trying to, you know, be there. And I think you struggle with that too, I would say, to some extent.
Yeah. I mean, there's a part of me wants to fight it and say that people need people who are less accepting in their lives.
True.
That there's this fine line between being the spark plug in someone else's life, even if that there's a risk of them getting pissed off or overstepping a boundary. Because the reality is that most people have accepted enormous levels of mediocrity.
Yeah.
And I mean mediocrity in the holistic way, like in life, mediocre relationships, mediocre job, mediocre impact, mediocre health, mediocre everything. And we need more people around us to say, this is really all you want? Like this is okay. And sometimes people are not going to take that. And we need to then be patient and then be.
You know what I turn on? You know what I turn on every time, like I like have the opportunity? I turn on The Last Dance, right? And I think what you're alluding to.
Is that
like
a movie?
The Michael, you've never seen the Michael Jordan Chicago Bulls documentary?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes. Yes.
So like.
All right. I live under a rock with most things pop culture. So I was like.
Well, that this came out.
I did watch that when it came out. Yeah.
2020. Right. And like, but like. I think what you're alluding to is there's a non-dichotomy there, which you say a lot, and I believe, right? And you've helped me see that too. It's like, but like Michael Jordan's gift was he was the best, and he wanted to push people to be the best. Phil Jackson's role was to like bring the team together. And I think what you're alluding to too is like, there's just moments. Like if you don't push me a few years ago to like, hey, get out of your own way and jump in, like I'm not hosting a podcast, you know, and I'm not making money doing like literally work that I love. Doesn't mean that it's not hard. Doesn't mean that it's that I'm not figuring it out. And doesn't mean that I know what I'm doing all the time. But like, if I don't have somebody like you who pushes me, right, then I stay stuck and then I perpetuate my story. And that's like where we got to get out of. And I think you're right. Cause you have to kind of, I love this thing. It's you are perfect the way you are, but you could always be better. I'm like, that's the way that's what I like.
I like it. So I'll give you mine. You started off the call saying we live in this world where like business coaches, there's a lot of people who are just doing that as a clear money grab. And I believe that a part of my issue in the last year or so is being hyper aware of an image, because I'm not a business coach. I don't identify as that title. When I started the Honey Badger Project, it was to start a business incubator. And in Silicon Valley, in the tech world where I model off of, there's no like business coaches in that process. It is a place that innovation exists. It's a place where people can come and learn how to bring ideas to life. It's a place that drives the industries forward because people agree to come together and start thinking differently. And I started in the last year or two being more conscious of what I didn't want to be perceived as, because the marketplace got so crowded with business coaches that I actually stifled my own unique message. I started to try to not sound like other people more than I wanted to sound like myself. Yeah. And that was one of the biggest lens that I'm still taking off, where I'm being less curated, I'm going to say tactical about the content and just saying, what do I want to talk about? And granted, it has to cross-reference with strategy, otherwise people have no idea what you do. But yeah, that was a big lens. I found myself counter-positioning with my marketing instead of positioning. Counter-positioning is trying to not be something, whereas positioning is saying, hey, this is the place where innovation happens in healthcare. Come join me. If that sounds interesting, come join this community. And desperately not wanting to sound like these people just hopping on, pretending to be business experts.
Well, and that's what, and I think like the principles of business are relatively like, let's just to really break it down. Like you need a service, you need a product, you need to talk about that thing, you need to learn how to sell it in a positive connotation, which we, I deal with a lot of people. You deal with a lot of people who think selling is a bad four-letter word, which is kind of dumb. I'm just gonna be honest, it's not. It's just communicating what you're trying to do and getting somebody on board. And then you need to deliver the product, right? But like I think one of the things, so yeah, it's like people want things to be easier, right? And then they have people who are like, oh, this is what you do, but there's a secret. It's like everywhere, right? It's rampant. Since strength and conditioning, it's like this is the secret, right? How do you like get people's attention? I think what's been awesome for me, just to use my own experience, is like I'm hosting a podcast. Is this hot podcast necessarily like an integral part of what's making me money right now? Not necessarily, but it's taking me in the direction I want to go with like my marketing strategy, right? And it's also it's really freaking fun. So like me making money and being in business for myself has allowed me to evolve my business, right? And I think that's one of the things people overlook is you got to like get in on the game and start going to figure out where you're gonna keep going, right? And that's hard for people who, maybe they're in a like to go back to the Matrix, like their mind is not free of the potentialities of getting in business for themselves. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
I mean the healthcare profession is in a myopic lens right now, just who thinks that there's only two options: either crush insurance visits 6 an hour or charge an exorbitant amount of money per session. And those two realities are like, I would literally choose to do something else. But if those are my only two options, I would be somewhere else. And the option in the middle, the ones that my practices all still use, is using technology to create a lower entry point for consumers that still disconnects this time from my income potential. But here's the reality is that most people have no business experience at all, so we have to start small. And we need to, if we use a gear analogy, a business is a machine that we build. And we need three gears to get started. We need the product. We need to offer something that's not just our time. And then we need a marketing method that gets that product in front of people to say, oh, that sounds interesting. And then we need a sales process that converts those people who are interested into clients. Those are the only three gears you need. But if that's all you do, then you'll be sort of trapped in your own machine. And that's where you have to then start installing other gears like automations or technology or team that then make the machine more efficient without as much time and energy and money from you. Then you get the privilege of tacking on things that don't technically matter. So your podcast right now doesn't matter, but in 5 years, I guarantee you it will matter, but you earn that privilege because of the model, right? And I think that's a huge part of what healthcare is missing is that they just see this dichotomy.
Well, like, and it's like innovation has been stifled, right? And individual practitioners who may have good ideas, like, don't see the pathway to utilize those good ideas. Because if you take them to like a bureaucratic place or you give them in the hands of somebody else, it's like they're just gonna not execute your thing very well, right? So it's tricky. And like, okay, so my own story is I went to PT school with the intention of opening a CrossFit gym, right? Or I was actually gonna go to medical school to open a gym, which would have been a terrible idea. Because like, oh yeah, I get a medical degree and be $400,000 in debt to open a gym. But I went to PT school with the goal of opening a CrossFit gym and then doing like rehab and training in the same space, right? You envisioned some form of entrepreneurial journey when you went to school,
Yes,
correct?
it did.
Like, so I think this idea had been planted in my head that I wanted to do something entrepreneurial, right? Same with you. There's a lot of practitioners who maybe don't have that, didn't have that, right? What would you say to, like, if you didn't have that, why should you venture out on your own? If you, you know, if they, like, yeah, give me your answer. No other caveats from me.
Yeah, there's the marketplace simply doesn't exist yet. So we're, if you look at every industry actually follows the same patterns since the beginning of modern business. And it's these cycles between basically small businesses then banding together to become giant businesses, and then those giant businesses falling apart, to which then an enormous amount of small businesses are created. And this period of consolidation and fragmentation occurs over and over again, but usually, it, depending on the industry, it could occur over a course of decades. And we've already seen this. So in the 90s, there was literally, I think, got 3 or 4 physical therapy chains. Like, that was it. And that was at the end of a consolidation period. And then one of the CEOs went to jail. You know, that's how this happens. They thought they were too big to fail, just like the current players in our system. The insurance companies think they're too big to fail. The giant VC-backed chains think they're too big to fail. Now, hospital systems are starting to trend in that direction too. Then when they do finally fail, all of the employees then come out and fragment and then start all these little businesses. Now, the cream will rise to the top. The most profitable businesses will start to realize that the fastest way to acquire more clients is no longer through direct-to-consumer marketing, but instead to acquire other smaller businesses. Then they'll realize, well, I can't afford to do that too often. What do? I go and raise money from investors. The investor money pulls in, conglomerates form, and the process, you know, they stay mission-driven for a period of time. Investors eventually take over the majority of the company. All decisions are made then through the lens of finances. The company then falls apart, and we repeat the process forever. So we are at the, in my opinion, at the tail end of the consolidation phase. And you want real? I'll come clean. I sold one of my clinics to a consolidation.
Yeah. And
so I had one clinic that was large enough out of the 5 that sold that went to a venture capital based company that started with 5 locations, got a little bit of seed money, got to 30 locations, got the real VC money, got to 100 locations, got the big bucks to then go from 100 to 300 or 400 or 500. And we were like acquisition, I don't know, 121 or something like that. The other 4 sold to more like local businesses and things of that nature, smaller players. So we're at the tail end of that, where these conglomerates are now running out of the mom and pops to buy. There's still honestly a couple of years left of it, in my opinion, maybe 1 to 2. But the fragmentation is also already starting, because we're seeing clinic managers now go, I'm tired of this, because they've been through cycles. Now, if anybody's in one of these giant chains, you know this phrase, the next bite of the apple will be bigger. So Dave, have you ever heard that phrase?
Yeah.
You have? So Basically what the VC companies do is say, Dave, listen, we're gonna buy your company. We're only gonna pay you out though, like the first 5%, 10%, because the second bite of the apple, when our private equity firm takes over, when we get taken over by another private equity firm, then you'll get paid out another 10 or 20 or 30%. And they basically trap everybody.
Yeah.
So we're finally at the point where people have been through that 1 or 2 cycles and they're saying, I'm done. I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
So back to your original question, what do you do? I believe that the market has never been better and you still have time to become an early mover if you now, by default, become a business owner. It's not that we all wanted it. In fact, I gave up on my entrepreneurial dreams in my final internship. My last CI convinced, I was one signature away. I had the gym lined up. Me and my best friend from PT school, Mark, we were going to do it. We were going to go inside of a gym in 2009. And the clinic manager, the owner, said, who do you think you are? How do you think you could start a business right out of school? And he got me. And I spent the next 6 years of my life there and got trapped.
Yeah. I mean, I was kind of on the verge, because, like, you know, I almost was like, I'm going to start a CrossFit gym, which I'm kind of thankful I didn't at 22 years old. my parents both ran their own businesses and stuff. My brother owns his own business. My brother also has lost a lot of hair, Frank. Has a gray beard, and he's doing well for himself, but it's like I saw the stress of the, and I don't want to say this in a bad way. My brother's also like one of the most stubborn sons of bitches there is in the world. Like, doesn't ask anybody for help, right?
Does he
Ever.
watch this? Does he listen to your podcast?
No, he doesn't. My brother doesn't think I love my brother. He loves me, but my brother doesn't give a shit about he the only thing he cares about is if I make a good meme. He's like, that was a good meme. But yeah, I like, I thought too, it's like, oh, I'm gonna go to PT school. I'm gonna get this education that's gonna help me. I also thought it was gonna like demystify a lot of the human, the human body type of things, when it's like, a lot of this stuff is getting people to do the stuff, the basics, the quote unquote, like the quote unquote stuff that is not very valuable. It's getting people to actually do that stuff. Like, like, let's change some of your habits. Let's help you realize that you can make these changes, right? But then, yeah, I got into a clinic and I'm like, oh, is this what I'm gonna start? Like, and I it kind of made me not want to do it. And then I got so low and I got so burnt out that I'm like, the only way for me to do this is to the only way to feel for me to feel good about what I'm pursuing is for me to pursue it on my own, right? And then you can't go back. And then you're like, no, never again.
All right,
So
Dave, I'm gonna zoom out. Ask me a harder question. I came onto this podcast thinking I was gonna be challenged.
what do you mean by that? I think
Give
I've
me a harder
started off
question.
like, I don't, I thought I asked you some good ones. I'm not trying to throw
The
you
first
softball
one was
questions.
good. The first one
Yeah.
was really good.
Then I got in the business mode and then I'm like, okay. So then you like, so, all right. So I one of the things I think about a lot is like leadership and how challenging that is. Did you want to freaking be a leader, or did you just feel like you're learning it, or do you feel like you suck at it? Where are you at on your leadership journey?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm a beginner, so I think that the where it started was my dad. My dad was a deputy chief of the sheriff's department, and the dude was just a seemingly a natural born leader. I mean, I was the youngest kid, so I grew up with him really in his like 40s and 50s. So I didn't know the younger version of him who became. And that guy, I mean, he was just an assume he was like a very assuming character. He had the whole get up, the sheriff's department get up, and I would watch him give public speeches. He was also a local politician for like school board, town mayor type stuff, county level type things. And I would just watch him get on stage and talk for 30 minutes, 60 minutes. He had never had notes, never knew what he was gonna say. I was like, how? Yeah, and I just sort of modeled that. That was my thing. But he led a team in the sheriff's department of hundreds, and I think that's where I just sort of always looked up to it. And when I was young, it was a model that I was like, I should be always looking for leadership positions. So I ran for. I didn't run for class president my senior year. Do you want to know why, Dave?
Why
In high
not?
school, my girlfriend at the time really wanted to be class president. And a little part of me is like, I'm proud of that. A little part of me is like, you should have just ran. So I ran for vice president, and that was really my first ever leadership position. And then in undergrad, I actually ran for class president of my freshman class. Guess what the results of that one was?
Not good for you.
Somewhere around like 1500 votes to 12, and I had 12. It wasn't just the two of us, but it was like this one guy who just destroyed everybody else by a
Was he
landslide.
tall?
Oh, I can't remember. I
Always a
just
tall
remember
guy.
he ran like a full-fledged campaign, and my campaign was that I was going to make sure we kept the smoothie bar because there was rumors that the smoothie bar was going to go away.
Where'd you go to undergrad?
Kane University in New Jersey.
Okay,
Yeah.
okay.
Small, shitty college, like state university. So where leadership, where's that come from? I kept always trying to put myself in leadership positions from then on, through this day.
What gives you the confidence to think you can lead people?
Oh, that's a good question. See, this is what we're talking about, Dave. This is what I'm not confident.
Yeah.
I would say that recently I have uncovered the difference between self-efficacy and confidence, in that what we all think we need is self-confidence, But what's a far superior quality is self-efficacy. What does that mean? It's belief in your ability to handle the downturns,
Yeah.
belief in your ability to handle uncertainty, belief in your ability to recover from trials, tribulations, and press on. And that I have that. Now, confidence may be related to that, but I actually don't consider myself a innately confident person.
Yeah. I don't know, like you talk about who's innately confident, and it's, again, non-dichotomy. I'm using your terminology there, but like it's kind of like being a psychopath is like innately confident for people, right? Like self-efficacy is a good way to look at it. Like, I always go back to it's like the Disney way, where the Disney way is, and you're a big fan of Disney, right? But like
I am.
the thing that people remember from their Disney experiences a lot of times is when things didn't go well, but then it was made right, right? And that almost like that's what leadership really probably is like when shit goes hits the fan, it's like, all right, how do we make this right? How do we get on the same page? And that almost buys more trust than yeah, just having a good, because like when you just have a seamless experience, it's like, well, that was what it was supposed to be, right? Expectations met reality. When it
Yeah.
comes to, go ahead, yeah, you're
I can
fine.
tell you about, so in my first business, we had five locations, almost 50 employees. And I remember reading about towards the tail end right before we were about to sell. I remember reading about this concept called radical transparency. And it's a leadership philosophy where you basically, in real time, update your team on what's going on, even if it's scary, bad, perceived to be negative. And I remembered in that moment, we were the opposite. We were always just trying to maintain an image that everything was good, even through ups and downs. I wasn't aware enough as an entrepreneur to realize that the ups and downs are always inevitable. There's no
Yeah.
business that's not operating in a wave sign. There's no linear business, period. And at that time, I realized I don't think this is working. And I think we corrected it in time to be able to sell the business, because selling the business requires a degree of radical transparency. When I started Honey Badger, I resolved to lead from the beginning with radical transparency. And you've seen me do it. So with you being on the inside in certain roles, when shit hits the fan, I literally tell the team. Now, radical transparency, in my opinion, is actually so easy. It's like people are terrified, leaders are terrified of it. But it's actually kind of a selfish way to lead, because I don't have to bear the burden anymore. I don't have to
Yeah.
bear the burden alone.
Yeah.
So if we have a huge downturn in leads, which is something we went through,
Yeah.
I'm like, guys, leads are down, like way down. What are your ideas? Like, how do we fix this? Like, I'm not able to turn around the way that I have in the past. Like, who has ideas? That's actually easier for me. But it's actually much harder to do.
Yeah.
Once you do it, it's actually easier. And it's actually harder as a team, because they have to burden. They have to share some of the burden. But most people, they want to. If you have the right team, they rise up and say, okay, let's figure this out.
Yeah. I mean, acceptance of reality is a good principle in life. It's just really hard to accept reality, and and also when you're the perception of leadership, pretty much for since humans have, recorded history, is like the leader is strong. The leader like bears the burdens of the world, right? And that's not really how tribes work, or groups of people work. So okay, like what are your you presented, was it CSM that you were at last year?
Yes.
What was it like? I haven't been back to an APTA thing. I haven't been to anything in our organization, like in our professional organization, in I think 5 or 6 years. Like, not because I just don't like glad handing. I just think it's like, oh yeah, we're all patting each other on the back. But like when you did that and you gave a talk, what I don't want to necessarily, you can go into the critiques of professional organization or like, but what was that environment like, and how do you think we need to change, or can we change, as like a profession?
Yeah.
Again, Like, this is giant stuff that we're talking about, and it's not necessarily critiques of any individual, but like as an organization, I think we're failing. Like, Vision 2020, me getting a doctorate, I'll be honest, like, do I need a freaking doctorate? Did I need a doctorate? I don't even know, right? It's nice to have doctor in front of my name for some people, but like, do I care? Me, not really, right? But like, I do see a lot of people. I saw this from a PT a few weeks ago or a week ago. It's like, hey, I'm $400,000 in debt, you know, because I got a doctorate and then I got a residency. And he just kept going down the intellectual route, right? And I think that's where some of we have failed as a profession to like help people not do that. And that's all a shit ton of money to be in debt to, right? So like, what are some of the things professionally at the organizational level, and then maybe down the road
Yeah.
here as a student, right? Or as somebody thinking about, let's go students, because nobody who's thinking about being a PT is necessarily going to listen to this. I don't know.
Yeah. No. Well, I'm gonna start. There's three topics in that question. We're gonna
Yeah, that
start
was a
with the
big
first
topic.
one.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
The first one is this whining about, oh, why are we doctors? Poor me, I'm a doctor, needs to fucking stop. This is nothing more than a self-depreciating, not looking at what this credential affords us the opportunity to do. And it's as though, well, I'm a doctor. How come you didn't hand me something to make me money as a doctor?
Yeah.
That's essentially what they're saying to the schools and the credentialing agencies and the professional organizations is, well, I got my doctorate. Why aren't you doing more for me?
Yeah.
Instead of saying, well, what can I do with my doctorate? Well, we have an entirely new level of direct access because of this. We have a whole nother level of ability to help directly get consumers directly get care because of this. And an authority, if we were to take ownership and actually make the doctorate title mean something, because I have my but the five locations, like they knew that we were their trusted resource. They
Yeah.
came to us first. They did
Yeah.
not think of going to the medical doctor when they had an orthopedic concern. They came to their doctor of physical therapy. But
Yeah.
we established that in their minds. We took ownership as a brand.
Yeah.
The brands that I currently run now, they view us as their authority. So this whole notion of feeling sad that we're a doctor and blaming, it's just another way where people are abdicating their own responsibility and terrified at the probably some sort of subconscious level to step into actually being that title.
Yeah, that's a good point. You just
Now,
changed my mind. You just helped me overcome that. Thank you.
good, that you're welcome. Sounds like the bell afterwards. So now the APTA is doing absolutely nothing. They brought me in there as part of a innovators panel, but didn't promote it at all. And it's essentially just lip service. You know, I offered all sorts of advice on how to drive innovation forward. And there's still some connections there that maybe will materialize one day. If I had to be honest with you, it's that there's a whole lot of good people. I actually really liked all the individuals that I met who were very high up in the APTA, including the president, great guy. The levels of bureaucracy strategically built into, they modeled it after the US government. And I'm saying, like, is that really necessary? Like, the physical therapy profession needs US government level protection against checks and balances and delegates and all like that. The government structured that way to protect against freedom, to make sure that nobody could just like take over the country. Our profession, I think we could probably peel back some layers so that we could start moving with speed. But it was actually built so rock solid from a checks and balances, nobody could actually dismantle it. The amount of coordination that it would take to dismantle the broken infrastructure of the APTA is too great for any one person. And so far, no one person has been able to rally the troops enough to be like, yeah, no, like we're going to do away with that part of this process. But when they do away with that part of the process, somebody's going to lose power. And no division of the APTA is willing to lose power for the greater good of physical therapy. That's the truth.
There was a third part of that question.
Students.
Students. So, okay, before, because this is maybe a better, it ties into that, right? It's like cash practice, and we talked about this, like there's a lot of people who like they hear cash practice, and even like students, like, you know, when I was a student and I was like, well, there are people who are like cash physical therapists. I'm like, why? Like, yeah, but like I'm a medical professional now. Why not let people use insurance, right? Or have people use insurance, right? So maybe that's two prong, but like, what is it that there's like this stigma against like being a cash practitioner? Why do you think people have that? And is that a narrative that can change?
Well, it's partially right because the old definition of the cash practice is charging
Super, yeah.
high ticket sessions in giant packages that 1% of people could afford. And that to me is not a, I don't want that. Our versions of cash practice use technology to have a lower entry point. So it's more affordable for the consumer. And oftentimes it's actually on par with in-network care, given rising deductibles and co-insurances. Now, here's how I know the tides are turning in the marketplace as far as consumers go. I recently had a chest x-ray. I billed it through insurance.
Yeah.
My out-of-pocket responsibility is more than it would have cost me if I had said, "Can I have the cash rate, please? I'll pay cash for this x-ray." And I don't, like, luckily don't consume a lot of healthcare. Like
Yeah.
I just don't trust anybody. So I often buy like my own blood work and I assess my own blood work myself. Or,
Yeah.
and then two, I'm fortunate to be relatively healthy.
Yeah.
So when I did have to consume healthcare, I didn't even know this whole thing about asking for a cash thing existed. I post on my personal Facebook page, "Explain to me how this is possible." You know, that I now owe, I don't know, $400 for this x-ray when I could have paid $100 out of pocket. And consumers, my friends that are not medical professionals, were chiming in, teaching me that you need to make sure you're asking every single practitioner what's the cash rate and what's the insurance rate because it's no longer guaranteed to be cheaper with insurance.
Yeah.
And I went, holy shit, the consumer world is catching up. So they are going to call physical therapy clinics and say, "So my deductible is $2,000 and my co-insurance is $50 a visit. And you want me here 3 times a week, and you think it's going to take 10 visits or, you know, something along those lines." So they're going to do the math and be like, "So this out of pocket is $2,500, where I'm going to go get supervised by a high school kid and do the same exercises that grandma's doing, and do the same exercise that the teenage kid is doing." And then they're going to realize, "Well, let me call the cash practices in town. And if you build a business with us, your package is probably around 2 grand." So you're going to say, "Well, yeah, let me see if I can help you." Then assess that you can help them, and then say, "Well, yeah, my package is 2,500, and it includes all these high touch things, and you don't have to come to the clinic 3 times a week, but you're actually going to get more to do daily." And people are going to see the value is so obviously lopsided. Now, if all you do is sell cash sessions, you're only one step removed from that, and chances are you're now going to be exorbitantly higher. So now you're going to say, "Well, yeah, if we're going to do 10 sessions for $200 and that's all you get, it's still viewed as less than the time leverage way, which includes a whole lot more." Yeah, and I think the tides are officially turning.
Yeah. So when it comes to like I was my segue into like fatherhood. There's a fatherhood question in here that I wrote down, but like you hit me up with a message, or you commented on, like, 'cause I made a post about I'm only gonna be so cool for so long, and you're like, you gotta evolve with your kids, right? And I think that's a good point, right? But when it comes to like, you're probably not gonna tell your kids what to do in life. Right. But you are giving them lessons about maybe the paths to pursue from a career standpoint. Would you have them go into physical therapy? Would you have them go into medicine? Or would you say
Yeah,
that these
if
are
that's what
things
they
for you
want
to
to
do?
do.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. The notion of this blanket, "I would never tell somebody to be a physical therapist," is ridiculous. If he has an interest in, let's say, just fitness, then okay, well, there's no reason to. If he has an interest in just nutrition, then he doesn't have a reason to. But yeah, absolutely. It's just a matter of making sure that he would be prepared to actually use the skill set in a way that makes sense. Because the thing that I try to teach my kids all the time, and I look for the tiniest things. You know, so if we'll use Disney. Disney has 30 lines in the front, right? 30 rows across. Where do you think the least line always is?
The least line. So wait, I don't
The
know. I don't. I've
smallest
never been
line.
the smallest line.
So if they're, oh, okay, you've never been, there's 30
No.
gates. All
Oh,
it's this
the least
entrance.
line. The least line is at the end.
The least line
No.
is always at the left. So
Oh,
anywhere you go, people will tend to go to the right.
okay.
And it takes the tiniest little bit of effort to do what the crowd is not doing. And it almost always gets you to where you want to go faster. And I look for the tiniest little things to point out, herd mentality, following the crowds. And I'm always trying to note that for them, that in life you're going to be around of a lot of people that are going to do similar things, and that doesn't make it normal or okay. It doesn't actually make it the best way to do something. So, like, if Frankie wants to be a physical therapist, I'd be like, cool. Just know that the majority of your friends are going to now go and get jobs at corporate jobs because they're terrified and they think they need to go get mentorship, and they're just going to make all these choices because that's what the generations before them did. You're going to choose differently. You're going to choose to create the career you want right off the bat.
What is it about the intellectual dumpster fire of going further and further? Because you have a bunch of credentials, and you've said this.
Not anymore.
Yeah, you just dropped them all. Yeah, stop paying for them all. But like, what is it about that people keep like? Because there's people I'm sure that you've interacted with. There's people that I've interacted. It's like, yeah, I want to start my own thing, but I gotta go learn this about this specific thing. And like, it's like, no, you freaking don't. Like, you can help people. And a lot of those things don't really matter that much, right? But it's people go down those rabbit holes, right? And I'm not saying that education is not important. Dude, I love learning and I want to learn, and I probably my bias is still to reading more than I should or XYZ, but like you don't need to go spend $750 or thousands of dollars all the time to learn stuff.
Well, my credentials used to be PT, DPT, OCS, SCS, CSCS, TPI-1, PN1, FMSC, and PES, and like maybe three other bullshit ones. And that was all before I became an entrepreneur. I was trying to out-educate imposter syndrome. And it becomes really easy to convince yourself that the next credential, that's going to be the one where I feel whole. That's going to be the one where I feel complete. And then I literally got every credential that could exist. I remember the one day where I'm like, well, what else would I get? I was like, oh shit. I actually don't think there's literally another credential. And that was true at that time. There was literally not another credential I could get that was relevant to my sports and orthopedics world. And I was like, I guess I just have to be okay.
You have to be whole. Which
I
are you
guess
whole,
that, yeah,
Frank? Are you whole?
I just have to choose to believe in myself.
Yeah. The choice to
And
believe in yourself and, like you said, self-efficacy of like, yeah, I'm gonna figure this out. And if there is somebody better suited, like, I'm not gonna work with national level track athletes. Like, that's okay. If I do want to start doing that, then I can go freaking learn, right? And try to get access to those people.
yeah.
So
Well, I've worked with at Team USA. I've worked at the Olympic headquarters, and that was the most garbage care I've ever seen. So
yeah.
I did a 2 week rotation in Colorado Springs for Team USA wrestling and boxing. And I was quite literally a glorified massage therapist where those athletes are conditioned to walk into the PT room and tell you what they
Yeah.
want. And
Yeah.
all of it was modalities.
Yeah.
None of it had any clinical reasoning.
Yeah.
I've also worked with the New York Giants, the New York Islanders, and better, but also ridiculous.
Yeah.
So I have worked at the highest level and saw that garbage and was like, okay, I'm good. And that happened after my businesses gave me those opportunities. That's really when my, let's say, clinical confidence took off. Because I got a peek inside the rooms that we all think are such high level, and it was
Yeah.
nonsense.
Yeah. That's why I work like working with 90-year-old Loreen coming to my garage, because I can be like, let's do some deadlifts. And she's like, all right, let's pick up some weight. And
Yep.
so yeah, because like that's, I think that's the facade that a lot of people go into PT school like winging. I'm gonna get to work with athletes, right? And I'm gonna get to do these high level things that I get to like be dude, I watched way too much of House. Did you ever watch House MD, where he's like the Sherlock Holmes? Like I was like, oh, I get to solve the problem, and it's like, oh, gonorrhea, like, you know, and it's like, it's never sh that shit. You're never figuring that out. And gonorrhea is not a great example, right? But like, you really, you know, we can get into this, because I kind of want to ask you, like, what do you miss? And you probably get to some, but like, what do you miss about treatment if you do, right? Maybe you don't. And that's okay too. I can see
Yeah,
that.
I mean, I still develop our clinical models. So to me, I'm operating at the highest level of my clinical expertise because I am developing both practice models for other people and clinical models inside my own businesses. So when we took on truck drivers health, so one of the companies I have ownership in is Offshift, and it helps truck drivers who have chronic ailments. Going through that process and trying to solve how to best help them was one of the coolest clinical explorations I've ever had. And you're being forced to think through sort of the societal macro levels because we know that on the ground it is implementation of the fundamentals. Then that I think ties into your whole like, oh, I wish I was house. There's a moment in every clinician's career where you go, oh, I guess it's kind of all the same, but not the same at the same time, but kind of all the same. So these like buckets of diagnoses typically get resolved by implementation of a handful of variables, not an unlimited amount of variables, which means the intellectual challenge is no longer piecing together the variables, but instead getting those known variables to actually happen because people are notoriously non-compliant with what they need to do. So if that's what we're doing at a one-on-one level, I believe doing that at the societal level for a specific problem or sport for a specific type of person is the highest level of intellect you could potentially use.
This wouldn't be a conversation between me and you if I didn't bring up a book. Have you ever read How Emotions Are Made by Lisa Bowen
No,
Barrett?
nope.
So what you're talking about is changing the story, right? The overstory of, you know, health and, you know, truck driving, like, you know, the stats because you're involved in that business. It's like really bad. Like after
16 years younger, they die
they die, like,
before the
yeah,
rest of the
at
world
like
because of their
59.
profession.
Yeah. So 16 years increase, they're all cause mortalities. It's terrible. But some of like that book is all about basically, or this book's all about like the old view of emotions are that like there's a specific part in your brain that's like the anger part and there's the fear part, right? And what she's really saying is like it's actually your brain is just always constructing like everything. Like, you know, if you like there's examples of this, but like somebody's you see their eyes and it's like, well, what is that? Is that fear or is that sc and like they could be eating ice cream, they just have their eyes open like that, right? You don't freaking know. But the story people tell is so like it's just predicting the same thing. It's like, ah, we can't do anything about this, right? Or it's terrible. And I think the problem and the what you're alluding to is like we if we're gonna solve these overarching problems that are implementation of a lot of the things like, hey, can you get 8 hours of sleep a night, right? Can you start to eat better while you're on the road? And what does that mean? Like require massive change, right, at scale that our healthcare system's just not doing, right?
100%. Yep, absolutely. And for anybody listening, my business building philosophy is to choose a target market or a niche. It doesn't have to be as specific as like truck drivers. That happened to be Mark, who is the founder of that company, his passion. But there's an algorithmic or formulaic approach that presents itself when you start solving the same problem all the time, or the same set of problems a specific person type of person has all the time. So my other client patient facing business is for combat sports, and MMA fighters face a very predictable group of problems, but it's a multitude of problems. It's still finite. It's not an unlimited amount of problems. So when you break down the list of their problems and solve them in order, there is a finite amount of solutions. And that's good because then we get to spend our intellectual brain power on how to design systems that solve that specific set of problems better, faster, more efficiently in new and unique ways. And that's a, in my opinion, a much more noble and worthy cause to spend our career than one random person after the next in these like very classic outpatient mills. Now, if you're somebody who works inside of a gym, chances are the type of people who go to that gym are lumped together. Now, it might be a little bit wider than truck drivers or fighters, but they're still lumped together and usually experience a similar grouping of problems: low back pain, neck pain, shoulder pain, wrist pain, or if they're it's a yoga studio, chances are they're going to have wrist and elbow and shoulder pain. Chances are they're going to have so when you choose a target market or a niche, you get to solve the same problems in new and unique ways by constantly iterating, which is a different, in my opinion, a better way to have intellectual stimulation than an endless conveyor belt of completely different people that you're pretending to solve in completely different ways.
So on that podcast that I did with Brad Stolberg, he says, as a writer, it's my job to I want to help people find the words, like explore the concepts, right? That's what being a writer is about. I think, and I'm like, that hit me. It's like, what is a teacher? A good teacher is someone that helps the individual learn the lesson, learn the principle, right? A good practitioner is somebody that like if you think that your job is just putting your hands on somebody, you're trying to solve problems with like the same input, right? And like the way I've grown to look at it more and more since, you know, honestly building out my business and trying to figure out the systems, but it's like I'm really trying to help them learn how to do it without like me doing it for them, because that's what so much of like how people have approached rehab and medicine is, I'm doing it for you, I'm fixing you. Like, no, I want to do you enough. I want to give you enough so that you keep going, right? Like that you keep involved in the process, but I also got to let you figure it out a little bit, because that's actually how you're going to change, right? And that's where I think there's a giant gap with how a lot of
Yeah.
people practice, right?
Well, I remember that existential crisis when I realized my hands weren't magic anymore. It was around 2014-ish when.
Dude, I realized that in PT school, and I was like, we're just pressing on bones here.
Yeah, I wasn't smart enough to realize that until 6 years in. But there's a certain existential moment where your value goes from what you do to people to the process that you take people through that gets an outcome. And there's actually a it's a lot more, oh man, what's the right word to say? It's you have to let go of like the old school healer identity that I think we get a lot of neurochemical stimulation from. That when you do something with your hands and there's some sort of immediate feedback and they say, wow, thank you. I mean, who doesn't love a good feeling when you get a cavitation? You just, you get that, you get that thoracic spine. Like you get it. You understand why the chiropractors, in the $1 million role, the ones that just do that over and over again, you get it. Like they get addicted, the patient gets addicted, they get paid for it. It all adds up. There's no mystery here because it's just as rewarding for the practitioner. When you remove your hands from the equation, you actually delay the feedback loop. There's a neurochemical instant feedback loop when you touch somebody and they report improvement that we now no longer get, that gets delayed until when they execute the process long enough to then go, wow, Dave, I feel so much better. And most clinicians kind of like, I don't know, a teenager with their phone who just gets so addicted to the stimulation of social media and the rapidness of their digital worlds, then they lose the ability to, let's say, enjoy fishing, where they can't go and enjoy slow things anymore. There's a certain neurochemical adaptation that we as practitioners actually have to go through to reinforce that what we're doing is helping. And we see this inside the program all the time when we have somebody start developing a process as a clinician. They are terrified the first few weeks that they get their first few clients, if it's actually working, if it's going to work. And even though they know that it's going to work, then when they get told it worked, there's a sense of disbelief. How many times do we see a win that goes, Oh my God, I can't believe it actually worked. The person's getting better. And then they need that feedback 10, 20, 30, 40 times before they start to get the neurochemical loop of, wow, my process is working. And then they could be freed from their hands. Then they could be freed from different modalities.
All right, last question because I gotta be somewhere in 6 minutes.
Wow,
But
Dave's big time at me. Go on.
no, big time. What's the most pronounced change you've made? You look back at yourself 5 years ago and you're like, damn, I'm a completely different human. Is there a thing, right? But yeah, that's when you kind of made, you went all in on like you what'd you do? You soundproofed your basement or your
Yep.
garage.
Yep.
What's changed? What's your biggest thing? If you actually sit back and reflect, what do you think that looks like? Or what would you say?
Good question. The truth is that it feels like I have changed in so many ways that I can't tell you that there is just one. I am quite literally a different human being because I came this way.
Yeah.
And the feeling of being in total control of your life is the most freeing, terrifying experience that humans can possibly experience. And if there was one thing that changed in the last 5 years, is that I have gained the resilience needed to live the rest of my life with conviction that I am committed to being in control. Now, the irony here to get spiritual, not religious, but spiritual, is that if when you go too far with that and you believe it's truly just on
Yeah.
you will crush yourself under the pressure.
Yeah.
And being in full autonomy of your life, in my opinion, requires you to have faith.
Yeah.
Faith in something. Doesn't have to be religion.
Yeah.
Faith in something bigger than yourself, faith in humanity, faith in the ability to drive a change, faith in others, faith in religion, spirit, God, universe.
Yeah.
Because when you do it all alone, you will, if you think that it's truly just you and you alone, you
Yeah.
will crack.
Yeah.
And I
True.
have come close to the point of cracking. And I would say the biggest difference is now I have a different kind of faith as a result of the journey.
My faith is in my wife. She's the grounded. No, but I mean, I will 100% attest to that because when I went really low, it was because I kind of took the extreme ownership concept too far. And I'm like, I can't reach out for help. I got to figure this out. And it's like, no, like, you do have to, it's on you, but that doesn't mean that you can't get other people to. There are plenty of other people who want to see you win. That usually requires you to commit, though. That usually requires you to commit to being on board with other people, right? And I think a lot of people are scared of that type of crap. But yeah, that's a good answer. You are the ship of Theseus, my friend.
I don't know what that
I
is.
look forward to meeting you in person someday, but I appreciate you coming on. Where can people find you, Frank?
Frank underscore Benedetto on Instagram. That's the best place.
The Honey Badger Project is on Instagram. I will say, and I don't make this type of claim often, but has truly changed my life. This guy's really changed my life. And it's a pleasure to have him on. He's 2 episodes past episode 50. I told him he could be episode 50, but I got two people in front of him. So appreciate you, Frank.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Peace.
Later.